Great. Good morning. All right. Sounds good. So it's 8:30, a little bit past that. Not our usual committee time, for good reason, I think. And I'm very grateful for that, but also grateful that we do have this time and that we were able to continue in this room, which I think is one of the nicest committee rooms that we have available to us as House members. And that certainly, as our work has gone on from the beginning of this committee, that we've been able to include people virtually and remotely. And I think particularly our committee, knowing how important our students, our teachers, our parents are out in the community, our administrators, then we've been able to hear from people from all over the state. And I do want to note what value that has to our process, and that we are very fortunate that we were one of the committees that were able to take advantage of that, because most of the other committees that we have in the House still do not have that option of that remote participation. So that is something that we can all, I think, look forward to in the future. That's not part of my script, but I think that we will start, actually, if I can just keep with you and make sure I'm reading the right minutes. Thank you. So our first order of business today is approving the minutes from Wednesday, March 8th. And Representative Keeler, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes, and would you like to make a motion to approve them?
I have reviewed them, Madam Chair, and I move the minutes for March 8th.
Thank you. Any discussion of the minutes of March 8th? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, we have approval of the minutes for March 8th. I did not start by saying I called this meeting of the House Education Policy Committee to order. All right, now we're all official. And we've just approved the minutes, but we are in order, and we have approved, and we do have a quorum this morning. I think we have full attendance. Well, very well done. But our main business today is House File 1269, and I am the author. And with that, I'm going to turn the gavel over to our Vice Chair, Representative Hill.
All right. As we wait for Representative Pryor to get set up, I wanted to remind members of the committee that today we're going to be marking up the education policy omnibus bill. Our process this morning will be to move first the House File 1269 before us, then we'll move on to the DE2 amendment for discussion and possible adoption before we move on to the DE1 amendment with amendments to the amendment. Finally, we'll vote to send the bill to Education Finance Committee. And so as we get set up, I want to just offer a quick reminder. Our committee time is a little bit different today. We, of course, are starting early, and we are scheduled to adjourn at 10 o'clock, and we're looking forward to completing our business before that time. And so as we move forward, Representative Pryor, whenever you're ready, may I have the motion that House File 1269 be before us here at the committee and be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my motion.
Thank you. Before we move the DE1 amendment that we've been working on, and we'd like to ask Representative Mueller if you wanted to make your way to the testifiers table. We've been working throughout the week here. I believe this is our third meeting working on File 1269. And so we'll start with Representative Mueller stepping up, as I believe she's going to lead off things. I'm sorry, DE2 amendment first.
We were doing this today. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, there are several of us from the minority party today in the committee that will be talking through the DE2. And so I don't know if you want us all to come to the testifier table, but we'll just be going through the three articles of the DE2 that you have in front of you today.
Wonderful. We have a list, and so I think we're going to go one at a time.
That sounds great. So thank you so much. All right, so members and Mr. Chair, thank you for considering the DE2 amendment that is in front of you. The DE2 amendment has three articles, and my job is to talk a little bit about article number one. This DE2 amendment focuses on the number one issue that faces our students, which is literacy. And we need to be able to acknowledge again and again the shocking statistics that over half of our students are not reading at grade level. That means that this is a crisis and it demands an immediate response. We have heard from several of our own constituents and from our own colleagues about how this is a crisis and that it needs to have a legislative response. So the Article 1 focuses on the science of reading. The amendment also, and you'll be hearing from my colleagues later, focuses on empowering our school leaders, teachers, and parents, and the community with education innovation and the clarity that MDE's role is to support and not discourage our innovation with bureaucrat inertia. That's in Article 2, which you'll be hearing from Representative Bateberg. And then finally, which you'll hear from both Representative Knutson and from Representative Erdahl, talking about some of the common ground that we have, including the revisions from the school trust land director from Representative Newton, enrollment preferences for students with deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf blind from Representative Richardson, and honoring American Indian students and recognizing their right to wear tribal regalia at graduation and to possess native tobacco use for spiritual and cultural practices from Representative Keeler. So we'll also be talking about some of the classes that Representative Erdahl especially has been working so hard to include for the last several years. And so that's kind of an overall. And what I'll do now is just kind of do a very quick overview of Article 1. Looking at Article 1, the DE2 puts the science of reading front and center with a definition of the science of reading that is clear, unambiguous, and unapologetic. It is not a conglomeration of three different definitions. It does not leave loopholes for our teacher prep schools or for our districts to continue to use a failed system of hold language, balanced literacy, or the three cueing method. It is articulate and specific about what would be funded and what would be required of our teacher prep programs to prepare our teachers so that they are able to then teach our students how to read. This article prohibits our teachers' preparation programs from preparing teachers to use the whole language, balanced literacy, or three cueing method of reading, and reinforces our intention to see our educators prepared and professionally developed in the science of reading so that our children can learn to read. You'll see that at the very beginning with the science of reading defined. You'll also see as the article continues what each of our definitions are as it relates to the science of reading. In section 2, it goes through our reading proficiency and rewrites that to make sure that when we talk about literacy, that we are going back to the science of reading definition. This further aligns and strengthens our current statute's provisions providing instruction intervention to attain and maintain grade level proficiency. I would like to speak also very briefly, because I was the author of this, in Article 3, which talks about the short call substitute language, which this short call substitute language is something that I have been working on since the beginning of my first term. And it is a bill that I got from my superintendent in my school district asking for more flexibility, asking for more autonomy so that they can have a direct pipeline to the members in our community who wish to come and do the noble job of substitute teaching. We know that it is, we are at a crisis. We have heard from both Pelsby and from teachers, from superintendents, from principals, that our teachers are having to cover classes that we cannot find substitutes for. There is a lack of substitutes in the pipeline, and many of that is from the barriers of from Pelsby and trying to get substitute teachers. This instead would honor the things that I have heard from my schools and from, frankly, almost all the schools in your districts as well. When I have talked to many of the superintendents and principals about my short call substitute teacher plan, they talk about how important it is for them to have flexibility and autonomy when they're hiring their substitute teachers. So this would, in Article 3, provides both a new framework for Pelsby to establish a short call substitute license, while also addressing the immediate need for substitute teachers with limited permission periods at the local school district level. We have heard from Pelsby that they are, you know, they have their substitute language. It still has a much more restrictive form than some of our substitute or some of our schools would like to see. And so I would, that's why my language is included in here. Literacy is learning, and it's really important that we are focusing on that. So that's why I've been looking, focusing on our Article 2 and then talking about short call substitutes. I'd like to be able to yield or go to Representative Bakeberg, who will talk about Article 2.
Wonderful. And with that, Representative, if you want to step up to the table, take a moment for transition. Thank you, Representative Mueller. And when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ben Bakeberg, Representative from 54B. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak about Article 2 of our DE. This is an important piece of legislation for our schools and particularly our teachers, our school boards, our administrators, superintendents, to really solidify and encourage local control. I think there are birds flying around in here all of a sudden.
I'm just trying to. We're usually
not here in the morning, are we?
So, and as I'm doing my job as a building principal, as I'm talking with administrators, this is one of the things that I constantly hear is, Ben, just let us do our job, get out of the way, and let us support our kids. So, to jump in, the current statutes include a number of provisions that empower local school districts to be innovative in their pursuit of preparing students for high school and then beyond high school. However, many of the provisions are unknown to school leaders, and I can attest to that. I've learned a lot just about what authority individual school districts have. But many of these statutes are unknown to school leaders because they're buried within the statutes or the language, and they're not clear, but they are intended to empower local school districts to make decisions without needing permission from the Department of Education. So I can tell you that I have experienced that. Mr. Withers and I have been talking, and I was like, I didn't know that. So this just clarifies that for local school districts to be able to make the decisions. This article would create a new chapter of law around educational innovation. It would modify current provisions, such as the experiential and applied learning opportunities, PTEC schools, and PTEC schools to be options for school leaders and communities without the heavy hand of the Department of Education. The language would also revise and codify current session law on educational innovation zones to be more local control, to have more local control and innovation. And I just want to give you an example of how the innovation zone has impacted my local school district. So parent-teacher conferences have been done the same way for years. And we noticed a trend that many of our families that worked shift work were not able to come to our evening parent-teacher conferences. So we got creative, and we used a flexible learning day calendar, and we do invitation conferences now, starting at 7:30 in the morning and going all the way until 7:30 at night. We were only able to do that because of the innovation zone. And then our students that were from 7:30 in the morning till 3 o'clock, those students were doing a distant learning day. And this was pre-COVID. We started all of this. It was very successful and has continued to be successful, but there are some questions in our district now if we can continue this. This would allow us, would ensure us, and provide the clarity to allow us to continue to do that. As a legislature, we should establish clear goals for student achievement and for the means of measuring success and attainment of high standards and expectations. Beyond that, we should also get out of the way, as legislators, we should get out of the way of school leaders, teachers, and parents as they work together at their local level to push innovation and collaboration at the local level. There's a couple other articles I want to, or provisions I'd like to also clarify. There's a provision that clarifies the school's responsibility on prohibiting bullying behavior on school-issued devices or personal devices on school property and activities. One of the things that principals often will get frustrated with is they have to deal with behavior that happens on a Saturday night on a personal device because of some of the statutes that we currently have. So this clarifies that. Another provision requires MDE to conduct an annual staffing review with a report to the legislature on federal or statutory requirements justifying the positions. This is exactly what school districts are doing across Minnesota right now. We are reviewing our staffing levels and we are making adjustments based on our enrollment. So it would simply have MDE do what the school districts are doing. And lastly, this provision would require any directive or guidance from MDE to be in writing and to include the contact person at the agency making the determination in the directive or the guidance. And I think, Rep. Keeler, you had two superintendents from your district down yesterday, and I was talking to them in the hallway, and I told them about this, and they're like, oh, that would be awesome, because we have been doing this runaround to try to get the person who made the decision about the issue that they were here dealing with. So it will be a very clear communication path for our school officials to be able to know who made the guidance, and then they can get the answer about why they made the guidance. So that's Article 2, and I would turn it over to Representative Knutson.
Before we move on to Representative Knutson, actually, well, we will be moving on. I have my list twisted around. Thank you, Representative, when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I am just going to highlight some of the provisions in the DE2 amendment under Article 3. Several of these provisions are already included in the DE1. One, Representative Bennett's bill that would allow more flexibility in non-public transportation agreements within school districts. Representative Gilman's bill, which would require post-secondary institutions to notify school districts when a high school student either withdraws or stops attending enrolled courses. Representative Erdahl, which I think he's going to speak to a little bit more, his civics bill. Representative Richardson's bill, which would allow for enrollment preference for students with a disability, deaf-blind, hard of hearing for certain charter schools. And Representative Keeler's bill, which has provisions for American Indians' rights to wear tribal regalia or objects of cultural significance for high school graduation, and allowing the carrying of medical pouches with loose tobacco for cultural and spiritual purposes. And that's all.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative. We'll move on next to Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to thank Chair Pryor and others for putting the civics provision in here. I have a little problem that I'd like to emphasize, though. First, this does address the credit issue that I think is very important, that civics be offered as a course for credit. It also includes the off-ramp that I included for higher-level courses, baccalaureate courses, and those types that have, if they have a civics component, then they are exempt from having to take this class. But they're missing a key change in here. I appreciate that it says that we encourage that civics be taught to 11th and 12th graders. My fear is that if school districts aren't doing it now, encouraging isn't going to make much difference to them. I remind you that this passed with the 11th and 12th grade provision twice through Democrat-controlled House of Representatives in Minnesota. So we have taken positions in the past on that. Essentially, to encourage doesn't mean anything. Ninth graders, in my contention, are simply not ready to learn about civics. They have a lot of other things in their lives that are more important to them in ninth grade. In 11th and 12th grade, students are getting their driver's licenses. They're registering to vote. They're registering for the military. And so the advent of citizenship and participating in our country is much more real because it's so much closer to them. Students learn what is meaningful to them. The way civics being taught now is not working. The proficiency rate, again, is less than 1 in 4. For some school districts, it is inconvenient to teach civics to 11th and 12th graders. This is not about convenience. This is about learning. Many schools across Minnesota do teach civics for credit to juniors or seniors, and they still offer plenty of electives and find that it works very well. That said, I'd like to express my gratitude again. Thank you for including pretty much what I would like to see in civics. Getting close. The process will continue, and hopefully we'll get everything right in the end. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. We'll go now back to Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for listening to our presentation on the DE2. You have heard from all of our members about how important it is for us to focus on literacy, to focus on local control, to empower our school districts to have innovation, empower them to be able to respond to their community needs in a way that makes sense to their local community, making sure that we're honoring our local officials that have been elected in the school district so that they're able to respond to the needs that they're seeing in our community. Being able to have all of these provisions in Article 2 put together. I mean, we've heard many bills in my first term about, you know, expanding the opportunity for online and flexible learning, and they're already in statute. They're right there for us to follow. And so making sure that they're really, that they are put in one place and highlighted so that our principals and our school districts are able to see them so that they can take advantage of the many opportunities that the statute already provides for our local districts to use. And then, of course, finally, making sure that we are putting a strong emphasis on literacy. When children learn how to read, they are empowered to read to learn. I gotta say that again, because honestly, if you cannot read, the next step of reading to learn doesn't happen. And I see that every day in my classrooms. And so we have to get this right. And that's why this is so incredibly focused in our DE2. If we are able to really focus on the science of reading, and we are able to get our teachers taught in the science of reading, which they have asked us already, and that we can see that now passed on to our students, this fixing this key deficiency in our education system will be able to look at other things and make our other challenges more manageable. I've already talked about how local control is innovation, and we've heard from so many testifiers how they want to bring ideas and passions to their own local communities, and we need to make sure that MDE is not stifling that. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you for listening to our presentation. I ask members to vote for our DE2, and I would request a roll call. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. A roll call has been requested. Thank you, Representative Mueller, and for the introduction to our colleagues for that. We're going to move on to committee action now. And Representative Mueller, as you get settled, may we get a motion to move the DE2 amendment before us?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? We'll start with Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I appreciate the presentation on the DE2 amendment. And I think what some of the things I heard was were things that we already agree on, particularly the importance of literacy. I heard some new ideas about how to more effectively work with our local school districts. I also heard, again, you know, sections that we really have very much agreed on, even though there may be some key parts that were left out of those. Appreciate knowing that we do have common ground, because it's nice to know as we get to this point in the session that we did find things that we agreed on. And that gives us, I think, a good basis for moving forward towards the end of session, and that we want to keep coming back and remembering those things. And then also appreciate, again, the discussion about civics from Representative Erdahl. And I don't think that that discussion is going to end. So, which is good, you know. I will, just as a comment for all of us, this is what we have in common, is that we passionately believe in an engaged citizenry. And it's almost like we don't want the bill to get passed, Representative Erdahl, so that you will keep bringing it back and we will keep talking about it. That is one of the advantages. And that you will keep coming back to try to get it passed. So, you know, there's so many reasons why we value the amendment that you brought forward. So I think we can kind of take this a little bit in order that they were presented, and then I think I will call on our department resource, Mr. Uni, to talk about some of the specific things that came up in Article 2. But let me start with the beginning, addressing, talking about some of the beginning points, the literacy and the substitute. The short-term substitution parts of it. And I think I can just say briefly, there's the literacy we are agreeing with. It's just that I believe that we have a much better and comprehensive literacy bill that we moved out of this committee and is in education finance, and that will be part of the final education bill. So we are not rejecting the points that you're making on literacy, but we are moving them forward into that broader discussion. I think that bill on literacy addresses not just the curriculum, but it also addresses all the reasons why children are not learning. It could be because of when they were, those beginning years, they were experiencing trauma in the home. They might have been homeless or housing insecure, I should say. They might have been food insecure. And so as we recognize the whole child in our classroom, we also are recognizing their barriers to literacy that happened in those early years. Actually, you know, when we're talking about the bold literacy plan, when we're talking about the multi-tiered systems of support, we are actually talking about supporting that whole child learning how to learn in the classroom. So that being one of the examples of what we will be addressing in our final education bill. Then the other part of it, and it's just as important, is we're addressing the resources we need to make it happen and how we can target those resources where they really get to the child in the classroom. And that's, I think, the value of our literacy bill that we heard in this committee. We are continuing to evolve and improve as it sits in right now in education finance, and will come forward again. And I have no doubt that even before we get to the final vote on the floor, we will have a better bill that addresses literacy, because that is a common goal of this committee and I think of this body, is to address the literacy needs of our children in schools now, and as to have the resources to do it. Quick mention of a substitute, short-term substitute. We are trying to address that, and I think that the bill that we brought forward actually is the start for how to do that right now. We want to make sure that we really do our things like background checks are not just paperwork. And Pell's be doing background checks is they use resources that is not available to school districts. And we know that Pellsby being able to be part of this process is still where we need to be as a state. I think we've got a good pilot program going forward, and that if that's something that needs, we hope that it's not something permanent in the state that we have this crisis with substitute, but it's something that we can continue to work with. I think now we're getting into Article 2, and if Mr. Chair, if I can call up an additional resource testifier for addressing some of the points that were brought forward, I would appreciate that.
Wonderful. Mr. Cooney, if you would like to step to the table, we'll get a little perspective from the department. Take a moment for that transition. Very good. Before you begin, please identify yourself and welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Ado Shuni, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. So I'm pulling up the document here, so pardon me as I get to the right spot for Article 2. Mr. Chair, committee members, Article 2, as was laid out, covers innovation zones, PTEC programs, as well as, I just want to make sure I'm covering everything here, and an innovation zone advisory panel, and then, of course, a revisor instruction. So this statute, I believe the innovation zone was originally passed, I think, in 2011 or 2012. We've had a couple edits to it over the course of the years. I think there were some minor grants that played into this space over the prior few years. There's been some edits, I think, in 2016 and in 2018 for expanded access to these opportunities. We have generally run technical assistance for this program out of the Office of Career and College Success, and we have also run kind of simultaneously or complementary to this program some investments as well as policy language around CTE consortiums. The access to this program, in terms of, I think Representative Bakeberg had mentioned some access to flexible learning year opportunities, has been a point of discussion over the prior few years. Just for refreshing everybody's memory, a flexible learning year program has been an application process from districts to the Department of Education for alternative calendars for the school years. One of the more common ones was the 4-day school week, and then the other one is the 45 days on, 15 days off year-round schools. And then the last edit to that statute was to assure that those that were not approved before a certain date could engage in flexible learning year programs if they were meeting their world's best workforce goals to continue in that program. In this space, we've received applications to be able to engage in innovative models. I don't have any specific examples of recent programs that we've engaged in, We'd be happy to come back and have an extended conversation about some of the programs in this space. This is, I think, for changes in this space in terms of what it would allow would, I think, necessitate a greater discussion in person. One of the areas I think that will provide innovation for districts that we have proposed in the policy bill that I know was a point, I think 2 years ago when some edits were brought forward by advocates, is access to being able to provide online instruction without an approval process. In our bill this year, we have shown a recognition that online learning or distance instruction is now a learning modality, just like any other modality. And so what we've put into our bill is a rewrite of the statute to make it make more sense, be streamlined and straightforward, as well as recognize that districts and charters already have the capacity to deliver distance learning, hybrid learning, without the need of a hybrid, without the need of an approval process. We are trying to move the department more to, I think, what Representative Bakeberg was getting to, of a continuous improvement assistance guidance position rather than a yes-no. And the only kind of approval process that we would retain in that setup is approval for supplemental online learning providers. Those are the programs, charters, districts that are providing courses to their students that are not their resident or open enrolled students that they are not ultimately responsible for graduating through their system. And so we, in our bill, do believe that we're moving towards that more innovative model around the online and learning instruction specifically. We are always open to more discussions around how we can facilitate more innovative approaches to education. I think when the commissioner came in January, I believe, to the committee, that was part of his explicit comments, is that he is always about working with districts and charter schools about how we can get to more innovative models at the local level. Additionally, I will say, Chair Pryor did mention the connection between this bill and what the and Chair Youakim's bill committee were seeing around budget proposals. I think you'll see in many of the governor's budget proposals, we're looking at providing access to opportunities for districts to implement local opportunities for their students around CTE, around rigorous coursework, around activating youth voices, and around approaches to literacy. So while not the same proposal that's in this bill, I think you'll find across the governor's and Chair Pryor's policy bill, as well as the governor's budget bill, more movement towards innovative approaches to education at the local level.
Thank you, Mr. Ooney. And follow-up, Representative Pryor?
I feel like I've said what, skipping it around, but including this, I think that I do appreciate the hearing the DE2 amendment, but I recommend I don't recommend it. So I would recommend a no vote on the DE2 amendment.
Thank you. We'll go next to Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't ever pass up an opportunity to talk about the Student Data Privacy Act, which I authored last session and passed into law last term. This is the first time thinking about this issue, but I was really interested in the changes on line 1730 around clarifying the obligations of schools around bullying for speech that is off campus, off school property. And I checked, and that is acceptable under the Student Data Privacy Act, which I remembered that it was, but like anti-bullying is specifically incorporated into that ability to look into speech by students and activities on their school-issued devices. And I do think that, like, just my first impulse is that this seems like a good idea because we are, like in Tinker v. Des Moines, the Supreme Court said, like, schools' constitutional rights do not stop at the schoolhouse gate. And we've seen schools, like, infringe more and more on student speech. But there was a recent Supreme Court case where that cheerleader said, like, F cheer off campus at a yogurt shop, and she got in trouble at school, and she actually won her case. So anyway, I just think that anti-bullying is incredibly important, but making sure that we really do have parameters around what students can say to one another, not in the school context, is important. So I'm just very interested in this and interested in continuing to talk about it, work on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Next up on our list is Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have just a few quick questions just so I can understand. One, I appreciate you guys all bringing it in one amendment. That helps. Sometimes, though, it prohibits us from actually maybe accepting something, which makes it hard, too, because there are some good things in here and a lot of overlap. I just have a few quick questions. I'll go by who presented the article, I guess, but if somebody else needs to answer, that's fine. I'm very concerned or confused on Article 3, Section 10, which adds another section on to, I believe it's on page, yeah, it's on page 24 to get there faster. It adds another section on to the duties of the commissioner that looks like you're saying that they can't use any state funds to fulfill a federal requirement. And that is very concerning in the fact that there's a lot of federal requirements that come with federal dollars for special education. So I'm just curious to where that language came from.
Thank you, Representative Joachim.
And I believe Representative Knudsen went over that article.
We're on page 24 of the DE2 amendment.
Lines 24.17 to 24.22.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Mueller.
I'll take that. Thank you, Chair Joachim. Going back to what we were, when we were talking to, this is the first thing that's coming to my brain, so sorry, it's kind of being a little disconnected. But when we were talking before about how when Chair Mueller talked about hiring those two people at MDE, and we were like, well, if it's been you have 490 people over there, if you have that many people over there, then you could have prioritized it ahead of time. This is saying that something that is federally funded or that that a position is required by federal requirements, that you have to use federal dollars for it instead of using state funding, so that when federal dollars actually are done, that you can't cannot continue to use state money to fund something that was a federal requirement. And so when that is actually finished, you can't, then it needs to be finished. And so then you would actually have to come to us and go through that whole process of asking for another FTE rather than just using state funding to hire another FTE that was federally required. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Follow-up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if you're talking about federal grant dollars that come through or ongoing programming, because my concern with this is it really prohibits the creativity of MDE to braid FTEs together to actually be more efficient. And we have a lot of federal pass-through dollars, especially in the area of special education, which this could become very complicated with, because those dollars need to go to the student and have more ties for that and need to be administered.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Joachim. If it's an ongoing position, there's already ongoing funding. We're talking about grants that would a special position that for a short amount of time, when that goes away, you can't just continue funding that with state dollars. Special education is not one of those things. Those are things that's federally mandated, and those should be continually funded both federally and state.
Representative
Mr. Chair, thank you for explaining that. Still very concerning, because we as a state have to fund MDE to do a job, and that's not how this is written. So that's one section I had a question on, and then the last, it's more a general, maybe we can talk offline because it's interesting. I'm just wondering, in Article 2, Section 52, are you creating an alternative diploma with that? Or what exactly is that doing? Article 2, Section 52 is page I should have written the page number down to get to it faster. Article 3. No, it's Article 2, Section 52. Yeah, Education Innovation Section.
Section 4, maybe?
Thank you. I just said the wrong section.
Oh, page 12.
Yes. Page 12, sorry, page 11. Yep, section 52, Education Innovation Research Zones Programs. And you move over to page 12, and you're starting on lines 12.15. Particularly 12.21 to 12.21, when it talks about granting high school diplomas to students who meet graduation requirements, and then you add in some other options. Just curious, and we can talk about it offline. I know some districts are starting to talk about alternative degrees, and this looked like an alternative diploma, which needs a lot of conversation than being just dropped into an amendment. And then just one other concern that I really do have a trouble with on line 18.10, creating lifetime subs, because people's situations and life changes, and you might not want them in your school anymore. So thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the leeway to ask a few questions.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Berg.
I actually have a question on the same section, and I'm certain I'm just confused when I read it, but is this saying that a student, thank you, 12.21, as we continue through that section, is it saying with the use of the and that you get a diploma or whatever alternative degree when you complete 4 years of high school and at least 1 year of post-secondary education, or like you don't get a degree unless you've completed high school and, because there's an and, at least 1 year of a post-secondary either career path, college, or 2 year? Or do you get to just get your high school degree like we have since the beginning of time?
Thank you, Representative. Is that directed to a particular member?
Literally anyone. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any response? And take a moment.
Thank you,
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Berg. This is just making clear that when a high school is also including PSEO, that this is a seamless process, that it doesn't have to be a whole lot of substitute language with, you know, course equivalency and all sorts of stuff. That when you are 4 years of high school and you have post-secondary education or you have career certification, that you are still receiving the high school diploma and any other things that you have that you've completed in that.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Berg.
Okay. If this were to be considered in the final omnibus bill, I would suggest it is completely rewritten to say that, because as it reads right now, with the 4 years of high school and, like, the only way to interpret that is you can't get a high school diploma until you do the traditional 4 years and whatever the PSEO or other four-year, two-year, or trades. So, right, if it's going to be considered, please just clearly write that, because that's not what this says. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. See no further discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you. Thank you for your questions. And as you know more than us, that our revisors are incredibly busy, and so writing things very quickly is bound to have a lot of different things going on. So obviously, as you consider our proposals and our DE, I thank you that you would look at them just as carefully as we have, so that we can check and clarify all those things. For collaborative team, I appreciate that. I did want to say a couple of things before we went, before I just did this final thing, and to Chair Pryor, you know, when you were talking about the science of reading, I really do like Representative Edelson's bill. What we're concerned with is that Representative Edelson's bill isn't in this. This is actually taking the section of about reading and making sure that it is clear that it is the science of reading. One of the problems that we've talked about with Representative Edelson's bill is that it is not clear. And so, and those proposals are in education finance, which is why that we only included these in the education policy bill. And in when you talked about making sure that we are looking at the whole child, if you look on line 1.14, it says that this is differentiated to meet the needs of individual students. The science of reading is not just it's a scientific process, but it can be differentiated to meet the needs of the students, and that's really important to understand. When we looked at the short call substitute language, and background checks are important. I don't disagree with that. But when we talk about and when we were asked to increase those background checks, those are background checks that are actually that you've asked us to do for short call subs that are not required for paraprofessionals. And paraprofessionals work with our most vulnerable population. And so making sure that we are being consistent in what we're asking for, that is important. And then finally, you know, I understand that putting these all together, you know, there's things that you agree with. That's really fantastic. There's things that you agree with, and there's things that we agree with in yours. But just like you've told us, oh, I wish you wouldn't put it all in one article because, or in one thing because there's things we like, that's the same what we feel with your bill as well. We also are several things that we appreciate and that we like, that we wish that we could vote on individually so that we could also stand together with you arm in arm with that. That's the nature of politics, and that's how that goes, unfortunately. So, again, I'm going to renew my motion to make sure that we have a roll call. But just to remember, the purpose of this is to really focus on literacy and local control, because literacy is learning, and local control is innovation. And so I, with that, members, thank you for your questions, and I would ask for your support on RDE.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. She's asked for a roll call, so Mrs. Anderson, can you please start the roll?
Yes. Chair Pryor.
No.
Vice Chair Hill.
No.
Representative Bakeberg.
Yes.
Representative Byrd.
No.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Frazier.
No.
Representative Keeler.
No.
Representative Knudsen.
Yes.
Representative Lee.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Erdahl.
Yes.
Representative Joachim.
No.
With 4 ayes and 8 nays, the amendment is not adopted.
The amendment is not adopted. Members will now move on to the DE1 amendment. Representative Pryor, may I get a motion to move the DE1 amendment before us?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Now that the DE1 amendment is formally before us and having had the walkthrough Tuesday and public testimony taken on Wednesday of this week, we'll take the amendments to the DE1 amendment before we adopt said amendment. We'll start with the author's A4 amendment. Representative Pryor, can I get a motion to move the A4 amendment before us?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Please introduce your amendment.
So this A4 amendment, there's a few things that it does, and some of them are very, very technical, which, as we know, at some point you need to get things fixed in your bill as you move things forward. And then some of the things that we had meant to include that we found we needed to update. There was an amendment that we had for the policy on malicious and sadistic conduct that is now added in this author's amendment that had come before us in committee. And then also some language that was introduced in the Senate. When we were talking about the probationary time for teachers, the bill that we heard actually as it moved toward into the next committee did change the number of days from 60 to 90. And I think that was also something that we heard in our committee. The feedback, the testimony that we heard is we're moving in the direction of the testimony, so it did make a change based on what we heard in committee. There's also some language about SLIFE, which I can't do it. Can't remember what the initials are. Students with limited or interrupted formal education. And that's just getting the definition into statute, getting that a little bit tighter. We also have some language in the author's amendment about e-learning plans. And then finally about an amendment on tiered three licensing, that we also included teachers that are receiving the tier three license are also exempted from the licensing test that other teacher, that the same as teachers and those in teacher approved preparation programs. So that's some highlights of the author's amendment.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Any discussion or questions? Seeing no further questions or discussion, let's move to adopting the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The A4 amendment is adopted. Our next amendment is the A3 amendment. My records indicate that Representative Joachim is offering the amendment. Representative Joachim, if you could make your way to the testifiers table, and when you're ready, make a motion to move the A3 amendment before us.
Try something new. Yeah. Super flex.
Motion before us is the A3 amendment. Representative Joachim, if you would, please speak to your amendment.
Yes, I will. Just having to get the right spot here. So A3 is really the result of more discussion between stakeholders and MDE around the areas of non-exclusionary discipline. This amendment addresses some of the concerns raised by the Principals Association related to alternatives to exclusionary discipline provisions in this bill. It clarifies that students may still be removed from class before applying the non-exclusionary discipline standard. So if something's happened, you can still take them out for a timeout, to go to the sensory room, take a break, de-escalate. So you can still remove them from the classroom before you have to start down the path of the other non-exclusionary discipline requirements. Rather than requiring parental involvement in pupil admission or readmission plans, it makes it so that the school must make reasonable attempts to obtain parental involvement. I think this kind of centers around the fact that we want kids back in the classroom learning as soon as they can. And sometimes the parents may not be able to come into school, or they aren't responding, or they, you know, we want to make sure that when the child's ready, they can go back in. And it also clarifies that the school district's continuing responsibility to a pupil after expulsion or withdrawal extends until they enroll in another school. Otherwise, some students may fall in between the cracks. And then also it deletes the section requiring information on pupil withdrawal agreements to be transferred to a pupil's new school district. This also responds to a concern from legal aid that this information should not be added to a student's permanent record if they were suspended. So that's the amendment. So it's not quite peace in the valley, but we're getting there. And I think there's continuing discussions.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative. Any discussion on the A3? Seeing none, we'll move on to adopting the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say no. The A3 amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Joachim. Up next, I'm going to move the A6. I believe it's Representative Keeler. If you'd like to make your way up, or if you're more comfortable, you're welcome to stay there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A6 amendment is really just adding tribal colleges as an option for the pathway. That's it.
Wonderful. And so we have a motion to move the A6?
No. That is my motion.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Very good. A6 is adopted. Now we'll move on to the adopting the DE1 as amended. This is not the final vote on the bill passage. Do we have any discussion for the adoption of the DE1 as amended? just want to pause for a moment there. Any discussion? Representative Baker.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, one of the things that we talked about in a previous, was that on Wednesday? The week is kind of blurring together at this point. But one of the things we talked about Wednesday was the PSEO statement of faith. And, you know, you, my colleagues across the aisle, you expressed some concerns about taxpayer dollars going to faith-based institutions that hold a statement of faith. I'd just like to remind all of us that we did, through this committee, through finance, we've passed a couple different bills to faith-based institutions, one of them being House File 5 for free breakfast and lunch. And there are faith-based institutions that will get public dollars, so we appreciate that. Because there are faith-based institutions that have a statement of faith that are part of the USDA food service program. So there are public dollars, and there are multiple other ways, I'm sure your researcher can tell you, that faith-based institutions with a statement of faith are getting public dollars. So, but I want to publicly thank Mr. Uni. He and I had a really good conversation on Wednesday, and so I want to thank you for that conversation. Because I've been pretty direct with the department, so I want to publicly thank you for that conversation. But one of the things that he and I talked about is that, just to be very blunt, people of faith feel discriminated against with this bill. And I'd like to, and I appreciate some of the movement that the department has taken, but if we go back to the original bill, there was a homeschool reporting requirement within that bill. We had tons of testifiers here, and I appreciate the department moving off of this, but we all received significant communication from families, and typically many of the families that choose to homeschool or to home educate their kids do it for religious reasons. Within the ethnic studies mandate, in the original bill, religion was not one of the protected classes listed in there. It is now, thankfully, but it wasn't originally. So I'm a baseball guy. That's two things. And now the third thing is the PSEO statement of faith. And students, and it's specific to an institution that requires a statement of faith. So that's the third strike. From a baseball perspective, students, and I just want to remind us that we are sending dollars to faith-based institutions. Students also have multiple options for PSEO, and according to the testifiers that testified on Wednesday, both of them went to another option for their PSEO. I have significant concerns that this is going to limit options for kids. According to the MDE staff at our last committee, this issue was first brought up around, I believe it was the 17-18 school year. That was 5 years ago. It was also shared that we needed to make this change because of possible litigation. Now, I'm just a principal, I'm not an attorney, but in my opinion, that if MDE continues down this this discriminatory path toward faith-based institutions, where we're already providing money to them in other areas, this will undoubtedly lead to litigation for us in the future. So I think it's important that we address that, we talk about that. We don't need to rehash it all, but by prohibiting religious institutions from participating in on-site PSEO, that the religious viewpoint as an express statement of faith, while allowing non-sectarian schools to participate in government programs that receive government money, regulates viewpoint, and this is a blatant discrimination. So, but looking at this at a high level, you know, this bill, I appreciate where we have common ground. And there are, we pointed that out today, we have common ground on different areas, but it is still very mandate heavy. I appreciate the movement on the discipline pieces. Like Chair Joachim pointed that out, that we've moved, but there's still some differences. And I still continue to hear from my administrative colleagues, but I still have significant concerns about this bill, and I still have significant concerns about the statement of faith requirement, because, frankly, it feels discriminatory to people from a worldview in my perspective that I see. So thank you for your time. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Representative. Quick follow-up, Representative Pryor.
And I do want to just address the beginning of the discussion about the faith-based statement. When we look at it, what it says, what we're trying to do is protect the students. We're not trying to stop money to go to faith-based institutions because, as we know, that we do this. But we're trying to stop the discrimination against particular students that would like to enroll in those post-secondary options, would like to have those post-secondary options. And we've had the research done, and, you know, Crown College, where it is, if that's close to where you live, your next option is 50 miles away.
Eden Prairie.
We were looking up on the map. So think if you're a high school student that doesn't drive, perhaps, that doesn't have access to transportation, you've lost one of your options because you can't sign that faith statement, and you are stopped from going there. They are rejecting you, and I think this is something that people have, also have a very strong feeling about, that you can be someone like me that is a practicing Christian, and I can't sign the statement that they've given me, and so I would feel discriminated against too. So this is what we're trying to do with that. It's not the institution and they're being faith-based that we're addressing, but it's the fact that our students are being rejected from these institutions that would like to go there. And that's what first came up in 2017, and it was like where the discussion is going right now. So if we want to have the legal discussions about what we can do and can't do, we've got people that would love to do that. It's not me. I'm thinking about the students that have said, I was rejected because of my faith. And that's where we are and where we'll be moving forward. And I think that this will be something that we'll have more discussions on.
All right. Very quickly, Representative Bakeberg, and then we have Representative Frazier.
Yeah, I would agree that we want to focus on the students. I think we just have a different group of students that we're thinking about. So, and that's okay. Like, we're in a society where we can have a healthy discussion and a debate. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to say, I think the focus is we're focusing on all of our students when we think about this language and who it protects. There's a saying that says, history may not always repeat itself, but it may rhyme, right? And I hear echoes back to the past. There used to be a doctrine called separate but equal. And that doctrine essentially said, you can have access to things, but they can be separated, but they have to be equal. And we're talking about choices here. What I've heard some folks say, well, there are other options. There's an option to be online. That's not even equal. You can't be on campus, you can't interact with other students. And in a personal sense, we've seen how our students have been impacted when they've been away from their peers during this pandemic. But we're saying that should be the option if you can't comply with a faith-based statement. And I think that's what we're trying to protect. We're trying to ensure that all of our students have the same options, they have equal access, and they have the opportunity to participate in these PSEO programs, which we know are highly successful, very beneficial to our students, but it has to be for all of our students. And we're trying to ensure that no students are excluded. I think that's why this is important.
Wonderful. Seeing no more on our list, we're going to move the D1 amendment.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Can I have the
please?
Final?
Well, we're not through to final passage yet. Is that what you're referring
okay.
to?
Okay, never mind.
Very good. And so all those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
Final
No.
The DE1 moves forward. And now we're on to our final motion to re-refer House File 1269 as amended to the Education Finance Committee, and we'll open it up for final remarks.
Should I make it? No, we're good.
Representative Mueller, I have you on the list. Would you like to?
Mr. Chair, I'm more than happy to go last if there's other people who would like to say anything.
Very, very well. Any other comments at this time? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. And thank you for this discussion. You know, I have been an educator for over almost 20 years, and I never fail to be amazed of things that happen when good people get together and have honest discussions. Like, it's true. We may have different philosophies and we may have different ideas, but just like what Representative or Chair Pryor said, we do care about our students. We do care about our teachers. We do care about our districts. And it is something that is common between all of us. And even though we may have different ways of getting around it, we do have that commonality. And like Chair Joachim said, there are several provisions in this bill which are really exciting and that we're really wanting to support. But also, like Representative Bakebird said, there are several positions in here that we just that I just cannot support. There's too many mandates, too many parts for our schools that they are going to have to comply with that tells them what to teach, how to teach, how to do their how to discipline their classroom, taking options away. And even though I know there's been concessions and there's continued discussion, I know that this does not go far enough. I have, and I will continue to say this over and over again, I'm concerned about making sure that we have high quality teachers, not because I believe that our teachers are not, that are in the classroom are not high quality, but because I want to make sure that our teacher preparation programs are going to prepare our teachers adequately. And by removing the teacher licensing exam completely and only relying on the rigor that is said in our teacher prep program, I think is a mistake. We need to be able to have an independent measure, an independent mechanism. I agree, it does not have to be a paper pencil test. I'm saying there has to be something. And by completely removing it is a mistake. And that's something that I believe is not, especially when currently, right now, you know, these tests are supposed to ensure that our teachers are competent in their content, that they know their pedagogy, and that they are competent in this in reading. And to remove that does remove that level of assurance. And again, I was not a good test taker, and I was not that person who would do well on a test. But there was a level of assurance that I was a qualified teacher, not just from our teacher prep programs. We see other states that are actually going the opposite and making sure that there's extra certification that our teachers are continuing to show proficiency in the science of reading and in their craft. And so that is something that is concerning to me. And I know while it's not in this bill, but it is in an education phi. I'm not an ed phi, so I did want to just say real quickly, I am concerned that we're removing the pathway of experience from tier two to tier three. I think that, again, what I have, what we have been concerned about this entire time is making sure that we are prioritizing what we have heard from our districts, which is we need to have an emphasis on literacy, we need to have good emphasis on local control, and making sure that we honor our superintendents, our principals, our elected school board officials. We give them flexibility and autonomy to do what is best in their school districts and respond to the needs that they see in their school districts. And currently, this bill does not do that. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I would recommend a no vote, and I would also ask for a roll call, please.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Joachim, did you have a quick follow-up?
Oh, yeah, you can go to other people if you want. I'm still processing, unless there's nobody else that's raised their hand. Okay, so then I'll just dive right in. So I just want to thank you all for all the discussions we've had here and those of you that are going to be moving with this bill to education finance. We still have a lot of great work we're going to do together and making sure that our schools actually have the money and the tools that they need to do the job. I think that's where you're seeing and hearing a lot of angst, both from teachers and districts, about what some folks call mandates here, because they haven't had the funding to do what we've asked them to do. If we would have indexed the formula to inflation 20 years ago, instead of $6,500 ADM, average daily membership, just for that base formula, it'd be over $10,000 now. So no wonder why folks are at the end of their rope and worried about what they're going to do to make sure that they get all this work done for our kids. And I think every person that's in our schools, every person that's on our school boards, I do believe they're there to make sure our kids have what they need. Everybody comes to the table with good intentions, and that's why it's great to have these discussions. It's also why it's important not to drop things in bills before we have the discussions through the committee process. So I want to thank Chair Pryor for always for making sure that everything you put in your bill we've talked about and that we've had there. We're trying to do that in education finance. That's why I was a little confused by some of the language in the amendment, because I'd never seen it, the DE2 amendment, because I'd never seen it before. I just want to stress again how important it is going to be this year to make sure that we fund our schools to the point that they need to do their job, both our administrators and our teachers. We need to make sure our teachers have the curriculum that they need. That's why it's important when we talk about literacy that we talk about Adelson's bill and funding some curriculum for the classroom to switch that over. It's why we talk about funding around teacher prep and the Teachers of Color and Indigenous Act that's really focusing on making sure our teachers are highly qualified in the classroom. I get a little confused when we get concerned about taking a test away for our Tier 3 and 4, yet our Tier 1 and 2 have not gone through alternative pathways or traditional pathways to get into the classroom, can then move into that Tier 3 without any pedagogy or testing. So I'm getting confused by that argument about that one test on teachers that have actually gone through the preparation, the alternative pathway, the traditional pathway. I think that will do much more to make sure that we get teachers into the classroom. I am still very concerned about Tier 1 and 2 and the prevalence of them in special education without having the support and the backing they need to work with some of our most vulnerable students. And I also am so excited that we're finally making some move forward on non-exclusionary discipline, just because we've been working on this for about 6 years now. And while I want to make sure our teachers, trust me, I have six of them in my family, that I want to make sure that they do have the tools to manage their classrooms, I also want to make sure that they have the training to do it so that we're not harming kids along the way. But with that, I just want to thank Representative Pryor for putting a really good bill together and for the continued discussion we're going to have as it moves to Ed Finance and some of the amazing work we're going to do for kids this year, hopefully with a lot of money. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And before we turn it over to Representative Pryor for closing comments, I too want to echo what I've heard with a message of thanks to the members of the committee for a great dialogue here today, and for the massive effort that each of you put into to getting us to this stage. So with that, closing remarks, please, Representative Pryor.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members, for everything. We started at a much easier time of the day than 8:30 in the morning usually, but, back at the beginning of our first meetings. And one of the things I want to call attention to is that we did not start from scratch. We've talked about being in the minority and you only get to vote against things even though there's things that you like. And when my first term, I was also in the minority. And so I know that I voted no all the time, even though there were things that I thought were important that I wanted to vote yes to. And that's just part of our process. And so what we do appreciate is the DE2 amendment and finding our areas of common ground and recognizing that and having a record of that. So I think that we do find ways to show agreement, especially as we find ways of being agreeable. That's always always a plus in any kind of deliberative body. But I don't think it's, you know, it's just our process that we end up voting no, even if there's things that we do agree with and would like to vote yes to. But to go back to this idea of, you know, this is we did not start from scratch. This is not all new material. I had the responsibility and the honor of being on conference committees in the two sessions before, and I've seen all this before. This came through committees before. This was passed off the House floor before, very, very, very much of this. And to go back to where it all started, too, it didn't just start from somebody's pen or somebody's computer saying, hey, let's change this statute about non-exclusionary discipline. It came from kids. It came from parents. It came from the community. It came from administrators. It came from a coalition of people, those provisions, that kept talking about it and bringing it forward over the years, saying, we've got a problem. And there is data to show the significance of this problem. And I won't go over that again because, you know, it's where we were, but not where we want to be. So those provisions, when we're talking about the ethnic studies provisions and saying, yep, this needs to be now part of our academic statutes, again, this is not something that we came up with this year, but this is something that came forward from our communities in the state that did not see themselves represented in our curriculum. And this is the moment in time where we acknowledge that and we start doing better in the future. So again, those provisions, I am so proud that we are able to carry in this policy bill and move on to education finance. And then also, the provisions on Indian education and that section of it, which is, I wish it could have been passed last year because everything was in last year's bill, but the fact that we've been able to call it up again, that we've had more discussions of it, that there's now an understanding that, you know, this is something we need to do and that we have common ground there. There's maybe one thing that would be one good outcome of the fact that we were not able to do that one in the past. There's more in the bill. It's most of it now when we get joined up, linked up with our resources that we now have available to do these things. I know that we're going to have an even stronger education bill at the end. So I think that the good parts of this bill, everybody takes credit for it. Parts that you don't like, we get it. The parts we have disagreements on, we feel strongly about it, and we'll be moving forward. So thank you, committee, for this work. And we have a couple more committees next week, just by the way. So we're not quite done, but we're getting there. So with that, members, I ask for your support for this bill.
Thank you. We had Representative Erdahl with a quick. We have about a minute here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Pryor, just a quick question to clarify, please. Is the intent to have one bill at the end or two?
Are you, as a reporter, is somebody trying to get you to find out how to be on record here? This bill is going to education finance.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. And with that, Representative Pryor renews her motion to re-refer House File 1269 as amended. The Education Finance Committee. We have had a roll call requested. Ms. Anderson, if you would, please take the roll.
Chair Pryor. Chair Pryor.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hill.
Yes.
Representative Bakeberg.
No.
Representative Berg.
Yes.
Representative Feist.
Yes.
Representative Frazier.
Yes.
Representative Keeler.
Yes.
Representative Knutson.
No.
Representative Lee.
Yes.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes no.
Representative Riddle.
No.
Representative Joachim.
Yes.
With 8 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is re-referred to Education Finance.
House File 1269 prevails and is on its way to the Finance Committee. And with that, our meeting is adjourned. Thank you.